In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All, less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
A slim-built man was struggling to make his way through the crowd. He was wearing a shabby labourer's suit and a battered silk hat that was far too big for his head. It was fixed with an advertisement for a well-known Newcastle hairdresser. The band of lads surrounding him were cheering and surging around him, blocking his progress and forcing him towards the river. He wasn't helped by the fact that he was trying to push a heavy wheelbarrow through the ranks of his over-enthusiastic supporters. And on the side of that barrow read the following message. John Martin, better known as Sawdust Jack, from Newcastle to London. Sawdust Jack did not have time to spare. He was in a race and he needed to get out of Newcastle. He proposed to cover at least 30 miles a day, and he was set on overtaking another wheelbarrow pedestrian and beating him to the streets of London. That race was somewhat lopsided. James Gordon, his adversary, had left his hometown of Dundee some weeks earlier. He'd passed through Newcastle over a week earlier, where he had similarly been met by a cheering crowd, applauded by a mass of street urchins, and serenaded by a band from a travelling menagerie. When Sawdust Jack left Newcastle on Monday the 21st November, Gordon was long gone, over 100 miles to the south, and with only 170 miles left between his wheelbarrow and London. In truth, the race was just paper talk, but the papers had the power to draw out the crowds in 1886. And when reporters got wind of a head-to-head long-distance wheelbarrow contest, they made hay with it, sending daily dispatches about the progress of the protagonists. Sawdust Jack only made it as far as Selby, after 105 miles and 4 days, and he gave up, owing to want of support. Then he fades rapidly from view. While James Gordon, on the other hand, progressed onwards to London and was welcomed as a conquering hero. But where, when the nation was transfixed by the great wheelbarrow craze of 1886, was Bob Carlyle, the original wheelbarrow pedestrian? Where indeed? Let's find out. From History Extra, this is The Tiger Tamer Who Went to Sea, the amazing life of Bob Carlyle. Victorian sailor, showman, and sportsman extraordinaire. I'm David Musgrove, and I'd like to introduce you to Bob Carlyle. This is episode 5, Crazy About Wheelbarrows. John Martin had a marvellous moniker as Sawdust Jack, but that memorable nickname was really the only thing that poor old John Martin had over his rival James Gordon in the Wheelbarrow Stakes. Not only did the Scotsman have a frankly unassailable head start from the off, but he also had a lighter barrow to push. One can only hope that Sawdust Jack's advertising deal with that Newcastle hairdresser helped to defray his expenses. The winner, James Gordon, got the full celebrity treatment, including a long write-up in the Illustrated London News, complete with picture, on Saturday, 11 December. He's described as follows.
James Gordon of Dundee, street porter, very poor man but brave one, having a wife and seven children to maintain, and having earnestly tried but in vain to keep them and himself by ordinary industry, has started with his wheelbarrow to walk to London and back at this unfavourable season of the year, and to accomplish the innocent feat in 60 days. It does not seem very difficult performance for a healthy man, but many will feel sympathy with him. And we are glad to know that, after reaching London on Monday week and resting 3 days, while exhibiting himself at the Westminster Royal Aquarium, this honest poor fellow is trudging and trundling his way home, receiving many pennies and shillings kindly dropped into his box.
We further learn that Gordon was 47 years old and had a disability in his right hand, which lacked thumb and three fingers due to an industrial accident. Due to a scarcity of work in Dundee, and inspired by the great deeds of his namesake, General Gordon, he'd built himself a wheelbarrow out of a couple of old barrow wheels and some leftover wood, and he'd departed Dundee on the 2nd of November to embark on his journey, which his wife described as daft. Gordon was lionised on his return and received an extraordinary reception in Dundee in January 1887 when he finally made it home. As the Newcastle Chronicle notes on the 8th of January,
his arrival at Dundee did not take place till nearly five. By this time, the patience of a crowd on the high street was exhausted, and when Gordon came in sight, he was severely jostled, his barrow was upset, and the wheels and handles were broken. Protected by the police, he managed to get shelter in an old theatre on Castle Street, where in a few hours he appeared publicly with his mutilated barrow. Altogether, it's calculated that from 40,000 to 50,000 of the inhabitants of Dundee were on the street on a cold, wet afternoon to witness this sorry spectacle.
So what on earth is going on? Why this sudden rush of interest in wheelbarrow pedestrianism? Well, it's pretty clear that the press created the sensation. Though James Gordon is made out to be something of an unfortunate wretch, tossed on the ties of fortune, in reality, he was playing the paper game just as well as Bob Carlyle did. And indeed E.P. Weston. There's a note in the Newcastle Evening Chronicle of 11th November reporting directly on a telegram that he's sent ahead to advise them of his imminent arrival in the city. So like Carlyle, he knew how to curry favour with the newsmen. Dr. Bob Nicholson is an expert in Victorian media and newspapers.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match. With Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
This episode is brought to you by Atlassian. Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Loom help power the collaboration needed for teams to accomplish what would otherwise be impossible alone. Because individually we're great, but together we're so much better. That's why millions of teams around the world, including 75% of the Fortune 500, trust Atlassian software for everything from space exploration and green energy to delivering pizzas and podcasts. Whether you're a team of 2, 200, or 2 million, Atlassian software is built to keep you connected and moving together as one.
It's so hard to know where these crazes come from because they just suddenly seem to erupt out of thin air, you know, that one person's doing it, somebody else thinks, oh, that sounds like a good idea, I'm going to do the same And then newspapers, I think, sensing a story there, you know, if there's a race to be had, if there's some kind of thing that you might bet on or where you might root for one person over another, you know, that does give it an extra bit of excitement. There are quite a lot of examples of this. I mean, a slightly larger one from America, a journalist named Nellie Bly tries to travel around the world in 80 days, you know, faster than Phileas Fogg does, you know, in the story. And she sets off, but then a rival newspaper immediately sends another woman to race her. And this is all happening in the 1880s as well. I mean, so that's bigger scale than wheelbarrow racing. But it's an example, I think, of how the papers sort of realized, oh, here's a kind of fascinating little story that people can root for. And you get regular updates. It's not the kind of race that's going to be over in a day. You know, every day you're wondering, how far has he got? Who's ahead? Is he going to make it? Is he going to be on time? You know, what terrible accident might have befallen him on this particular road? Is the weather going to get in the way? As weird as it sounds to say a man walking with a wheelbarrow could be high drama, I think in the right hands, it can be.
It's not very difficult at all to find other crazes around the same time. In the very same year, 1886, as the wheelbarrow craze was kicking off, for instance, there was also a fasting craze. Inspired, it seems, by an Italian called Malatti, who was fasting in Paris, various people followed his lead and tried to starve themselves for 30 days. They included an English lady who kept a boarding house, a minister of foreign extraction in Kent, a buxom young lyric artist from New York, and an anglicised Frenchman who paints silk for a living. Most notable, perhaps, was a gentleman by the name of Succi, who survived on a mysterious medical drink, which meant that after 22 days of non-eating, he was still able to fence and partake in long walks. Skip forward a few years and we have a craze dedicated to eating rather than fasting, the pigeon-eating craze of 1901. Burnley Gazette of Wednesday, 13 March 1901, records that the craze was spreading across Yorkshire, with several men attempting to eat a pigeon a day for 15 days on the trot. As ever, things escalated, with a Nottinghamshire man called Sproston eating a page of the local paper before tucking into his pigeon every day. And then, in a frankly dark twist, as the Bradford Daily Telegraph for Monday, 11th March 1901 reports.
A Methley man, who has accounted for 8 pigeons in as many days, is now offering to back himself to accomplish a more extraordinary feat. With his hands secured behind his back, he will catch, worry, and eat a rat in an enclosed space 40 yards square, or he will worry 7 rats and eat one in a pit.
Now that's pretty strange behaviour. The Northern Weekly Gazette of Saturday, 7th March 1908, rounded up a few of the other more eccentric activities that had gripped the world in recent years.
Another curious undertaking was that of an American who, for a wager, shut himself in a room for 7 years. Not long since a Brussels resident left the Belgian capital with the intention of walking backwards round the world, a Danish journalist started to walk round the world with his hands tied. A few years ago, a young Austrian wheeled his wife and child 17,400 miles in a perambulator, and a German travelled from Hamburg to New York in a packing case 6 foot long, 4 foot high, and 3 foot wide.
I shan't bore you with the roller skating craze of 1911, but suffice to say that the wheelbarrow racing craze was perhaps not the oddest of the manias taking hold of people around the time. As so often happens, it wasn't long before the papers started to take aim at the very people they'd built up. Reports soon began to take on a distinctly mocking tone, particularly in the London press, expressing incredulity at the ridiculousness of the endeavour, with one correspondent worrying that were Gordon's exploits to set a precedent, we might have the North Road blocked by Scotch nursemaids wheeling their perambulators vigorously towards London, while another opined that if this idea is encouraged to any extent, the result will probably be that in short time, Bonnie Dundee will be evacuated and its entire population will be trundling wheelbarrows towards London at express train speed to the danger of the lives and limbs of the sane community. This rising sense of derision did not dampen enthusiasm for those who saw a chance to make their own names through the wonder of the wheelbarrow. Let's hear about some of the challengers to Gordon's wheelbarrow crown. First we have Ewing, the Ayrshire wheelbarrow man, who was wearing a conspicuous dress of red and drawing large crowds as he left Dowry Cross for London in January. Then there's our first female contender, Mrs. McGowan of Perth, who was heading south not with a wheelbarrow, but with a perambulator containing her 8-month-old baby and looking to raise money in light of her husband's unemployment. Shall we go on? What about the Aberdeen men, Robert Jamieson and William Stroon, the latter a fish cadger, who were both looking to trundle barrows from there to John O'Groats in February? Stroon was later reported to have been deceived by a destitute local youth, deprived of his barrow, and then disappointed to find it disbanded later on. James Sprake, a one-armed man with a specially adapted barrow attached to him via a strap, was readying for a trip from Kirkcaldy to John O'Groats and then down to Land's End. Not long after, John Graham, who was described in the contemporary term as a cripple, arrived in Shoreditch from Newcastle, having wheeled a barrow the whole way. It wasn't just one-way traffic from the north either. By March, things were getting ridiculous, if they weren't already. James Sanderson, a miner, left Shoreditch, heading north for Morpeth, with a wheelbarrow containing a miner's tub weighing 300 weight. Then we have George Fazzy, a South Shields man, who decided that a barrow was for stiffs and instead proposed pushing a coffin mounted on tricycle wheels on the well-trodden path. For an added twist of newsworthy copy, the coffin was one that Fazzy himself intended to be buried in. Late March, the one-legged wheelbarrow man Robert Cooper set off from Crieff for Edinburgh, but sadly caused little or no excitement, for the people of Crieff seemed to have got tired of this wheelbarrow challenge. Disabled athletes seemed to have been attracted to it though. Michael Herriot, in June 1887, travelled from Cramond Bridge to London and back in 28 days. He had only one arm, and an iron hook attached to his armless sleeve was used in place of the absent organ. As the summer progressed, the wheelbarrow mania was dying down, and exponents of the art were finding limited patronage. By January 1888, the craze had well and truly petered out in Britain. But one man at least was hoping to find a new territory to exploit, as he was reported to be on his way to Rome via Paris from Hartlepool with a wheelbarrow. Despite the media saturation and overexposure of wheelbarrow walking, James Gordon continued to be celebrated. He attributed his success to bathing his feet and joints every other day with whiskey. But on his return, he was just as happy to bathe in and profit from his newfound celebrity. As a tragic and somewhat tawdry coda to the great wheelbarrow craze of 86-87, it should be noted that James Gordon, the man who kicked it all off, was convicted of a crime in Dundee in August 1888. The charge? Theft of the wheels and axle of a wheelbarrow. So what was this short-lived craze all about? Well, it bears saying that Britain in the 1880s was in the thick of an economic depression, and 1886 and 87 were years of particularly high unemployment. Most of the wheelbarrowists we've encountered seem to have been very hard up, and in many cases, physically disabled as well. So this might have seemed like the only way to support themselves. As we've heard, there was a healthy dose of cynicism about the whole enterprise, and perhaps the biggest challenge facing the barrow contenders was to show themselves as deserving athletic entrepreneurs, rather than undeserving vagrants. This comment in the Fife Herald in February 1887 sums it up, I think.
To our own verdant and unsophisticated fancy, there is no difference between a tramp plus a wheelbarrow and a tramp minus a wheelbarrow, except perhaps that the one is slightly more of a nuisance than the other. The one comes honestly, although he may have a lie in his mouth. He wants to make money and he asks it. The other makes a pretense of doing something which shall place him upon a higher level than the common beggar, and, in a way, entitles him to the support of the public. But the instinct in both is the same, to get the maximum of hard cash with the minimum of hard work.
Before we leave this great high and great low of wheelbarrow pedestrianism, we should spend a couple of minutes talking about the vehicles in question. What about Bob Collar's original barrow from his 1879 Land's End to John O'Groats Walk, the expedition that kicked this whole thing off? It's described variously in reports as a porter's light barrow carrying a carpet bag tin box which contains clothes and other necessities, and a long, lightly built machine with the pedestrian luggage in the box and a Union Jack floating over the side. There are quite a few Victorian wheelbarrows for sale on the internet. In my efforts to establish what sort of barrow we're talking about, I thought I'd better find an actual wheelwright. There aren't that many left, but the fine folk at the Cornish Museum of Life in Helston put me on to Terry Ansell, who works as a wheelwright down the road from them in the Lizard Peninsula. Terry very kindly drew me a sketch of what I should be looking for. So armed with that sketch, I went back on the internet, and very luckily, a chap in Devon was clearing out his garage and selling something that looked very much like what I'd seen in the sketch from Terry Ansell. So now I'm the proud owner of a Victorian porter's barrow. And in the interest of historical research, I have pushed it around a fair bit. It's about a metre long, with one single wooden wheel in the centre, shod with a sheaf of iron around it, no suspension, and a wooden lattice frame to keep it light, so it's not solid. The wooden handles are satisfyingly worn and comfortable to hold, and it's pretty easy to handle, not bad around corners. It makes a relaxing clunk as the wheels rotate on its axle, but the noise of the iron band on modern tarmac does great after a while. Loaded with a box of possessions and running on rougher paths, I fancy it would be pretty hard work on the shoulders, and I can't really imagine pushing it for 40-odd miles day after day like Bob Carlyle did. Maybe that's enough about wheelbarrow technicalities. But of course, the difficulty of pushing or pulling these things around for ridiculous distances was why the newspapers picked up on it, and why they found the wheelbarrow men good copy. Before his fall from grace, Gordon was generally feted in the papers as the original wheelbarrow man. But of course we know that's not accurate, either in terms of originality or contraption, and Bob Carlyle really deserves that moniker. So let's pick up on what Bob's been doing while this craze has been playing out. As you will recall from episode 2, he swapped stints on the seas with circus work and walking, and around this time, he was busy sailing. I can't pinpoint exactly where he was when the wheelbarrow craze was in full swing, but I'm pretty sure it wasn't anywhere near Newcastle. I do know that he was back on dry land in Britain by March 1887, attempting a series of six-day challenges through May, June and July, and working as a painter of the local milestone around his old hometown of Haddington. I suspect his mind was on other things in the summer, because his third child, Robert, who'd been born in 1881, passed away from scarlet fever in July 1887. And there is a very curious sketch published in the Haddingtonshire Courier a few weeks prior to this, attributed to Carlyle, where he fictionalises an account of a journey by an agricultural labourer, his wife and their son, from one farm to another. The son is stricken by disease and seems to be near death, and the story is an emotionally charged and deeply Christian account of his final journey to heaven. If ever we see beyond the heavily starched or dramatically charged tone of Carlyle's normal writing, it's here, and it shows a man deeply attached to his family and his faith, or at least that's the way I see it. He describes the mourning father as follows.
The man was a fine specimen of the Scotch agricultural labourer. He was dressed plainly, but substantially, in a sort of grey suit. The lower part of his weather-beaten features was covered with a thick, full beard.
So maybe that's how Bob Carlyle saw himself when he looked in the mirror. It's a little window into his mind. But he didn't dwell on things for too long. As Awesome loomed, Carlyle got a surprising, and no doubt welcome invitation, that pitched him right back into the circus business. It was from Buffalo Bill, who had seemingly heard of Carlyle's walking prowess, and wanted him to progress from Scotland to the American showman's Wild West encampment in London, bearing the Stars and Stripes and the Union Jack as he went, presumably to drum up business for his cowboy and Indian extravaganza. This is a bit of a turn up for the books. Dr. Bob Nicholson.
Buffalo Bill is probably one of the most famous Americans of the 19th century. I mean, I'd put him alongside, you know, Abraham Lincoln, Thomas Edison, and Mark Twain, maybe, as the kind of the big ones, the genuine household names in Britain. Oh, he is hugely popular when he arrives in Britain. He sets up camp in London, bringing, you know, hundreds of cowboys, Native American performers, and he absolutely takes London by storm. You know, I think well over a million people go and see him. He is, you know, the biggest thing of the year. And then he tours around, you know, all over the country. You know, Queen Victoria goes to see him multiple times, I think, in London. I mean, he is a genuine global celebrity and really kickstarts kind of British fascination with cowboys. And in his wake, there are loads of other, you know, sort of knockoff Buffalo Bills touring around Britain, all trying to kind of cash in on that background, to the point that I'm kind of surprised that Carlyle does not claim to be a cowboy at some point and try to kind of, you know, go in for that business himself. I mean, he pretty much invents that whole idea of the Wild West that we'd later see, you know, on cinema screens. You get, you know, kids writing letters to him saying, "Oh, won't you let me run away with you to the Wild West? I've packed my bags, I'm ready to go." You've got women throwing themselves and proposing at cowboys. You know, it is a huge cultural phenomenon.
Carlyle didn't stay long with the Wild West show in the end. In 1888, he was back with Bostock's show and travelling into South Wales. There was one notable incident where Bostock's large elephant died. According to Bob, they filled the carcass with carbolic, put it in a wagon and conveyed it to Swansea and showed it as a dead animal for a few days. It was bad luck and bad business for Mrs. Bostock, though, who had recently refused an incredible offer of £2,000 for the animal from Buffalo Bill. After that, Carlyle took sail again, but in the autumn of 1889, he was home and once more attempted to walk 5,000 miles in 100 days, pushing a wheelbarrow. It feels like the general enthusiasm for wheelbarrow-based endurance exploits was much diminished, though. No doubt the craze that had risen and collapsed a couple of years previously had sucked the life out of the whole idea. He gave up after 1,300 miles or so, which is still quite a long way, because frankly, it sounds like nobody really cared anymore. And in Scotland, they wouldn't even stamp his book for him. So the world was moving on, and Bob Carlyle needed to move on too. But before he did, it seems like he made one last-ditch attempt to secure his place in the annals of wheelbarrow pedestrianism. as the Newcastle Chronicle, surely prompted by Carlyle himself, stated on the 14th of June, 1890.
It may not be generally known that Mr. Bob Carlyle claims to be the first wheelbarrow pedestrian who has walked from Land's End to John O'Groats and back to Land's End. This, he said, he did 11 years ago before Gordon, and he used a proper wheelbarrow, not a handcart.
So, finally, Carlyle had attempted to correct the record. But, as we so often find with social media today, it's very hard to fight back against fake news once the word is out. Before we move on, we can't allow that reference to Carlyle's famous wheelbarrow to go unremarked. So, what happened to that trusty barrow that Carlyle was so desperate to remind everyone was not just any old handcart? Well, that same article also makes reference to a Mr. Burton's museum in Falmouth. The museum, or curiosity shop as it was widely known, was a notable landmark in the Cornish coastal town, jammed to the rafters with exotica from around the globe. And, as the Cornishman paper told its readers in 1891, some of its curios came from closer to home.
Inside the doorway were arms taken from different parts of the world. Close by was a portion of the skeleton of a whale, 64 feet long, which became stranded on the Cornish coast many years ago. And alongside hung the wheelbarrow, which Carlyle trundled from Land's End to John O'Groats.
In our final episode, we'll see whether Carlyle can make a comeback and find a way to employ his undoubted talents of self-promotion and media manipulation to get the public back on his side for his long-distance endurance efforts. And indeed, what he does once he has his wheelbarrow back in 1905. That was episode 5 of History Extra's The Tiger Tamer Who Went to Sea. If you'd like to know more about Victorian newspapers and mass media, and you're a History Extra member, you can watch an extended bonus interview on the subject with Dr. Bob Nicholson. Go to historyextra.com/tiger-tamer-series to access that. This is a History Extra production, researched, written and hosted by me, David Musgrove. My colleagues Rhiannon Davis, Ellie Cawthorn, Eleanor Evans and Rob Attar improved the script. Dr. Bob Nicholson kindly gave it a read through, and the producer was Jack Bateman. My experts in this series are Professor Valerie Sanders, Dr. Bob Nicholson, Dr. Anne-Marie McAllister, Dr. Martin Wilcox, Dr. John Wolfe, and Professor Dave Day. Thanks also to Sarah Williams, editor of Who Do You Think You Are magazine, for her help with untangling the genealogy. I'm also grateful to Chris Godfrey-Morell and Ken Bogle of Midlothian Council Library Service for helping to find the Black Collection in their archive. I owe thanks to Craig Statham, formerly of East Lothian Archives, and Hanita Ritchie in the John Gray Centre there, who helped me to track down some local records in East Lothian, Lisa D. Tommaso, librarian at the Murab Library in Penzance, and Linda Camage of the Penwith Local History Group were also generous with their time. The Museum of Cornish Life in Helston put me in touch with the wheelwright Terry Ansell, who helped me to understand more about Victorian wheelbarrows generally. Numerous other historians answered curious questions from me, including Dr. Richard Scully, Professor Nicholas Croson, Professor Rosalind Crone, and Dr. Vanessa Heggie. Finally, if you're interested in studying archive newspaper sources yourself, as a History Extra podcast listener, you can get a 10% discount on subscription to the British Newspaper Archive. Just go to britishnewspaperarchive.co.uk and use the code BNAHIST24 at checkout. And that offer is valid until 31 July 2024.